I giggle with my friend that on my gravestone, may it be a very long time away, that it will say she overdid it, because literally all I do is
without
overdo
any
it.
Grammatical errors on it. Though. Right, exactly. Yeah, how to make sure someone doesn't rest in peace.
Yeah.
Rambling on.
That's it.
Rambling on.
Welcome to Rabbiting On. It's wonderful to be back together, the three of us in conversation. I am Rabbi Miriam Berger, and together this Rabbiting On, as always, with Rabbis Robin Ashworth-Steen and Rabbi Debbie Young-Summers. Lovely to see you both.
Hello.
Hi.
Hello. So Monday this week fell on the Hebrew date of the 15th of Shvat, or as we know it best, Tu Bishvat, the Jewish New Year for trees. And it'd be easy to talk about it as the fascinating tax year that it clearly is rooted in. But actually, as we emerged into Tu Bishvat this time, we were still holding on to the horrendous weekend that we had seen unfold before us. Such a distressing Shabbat following the taking of hostages in the congregation in Texas, Beit Yisrael or Beth Israel, a Reform community, an HUC trained rabbi. It felt so incredibly close to home, not to mention the British gunman, Malik Faisal Akram. So as we watched that emerge, as we followed it so intently, I think for me, there was a real sense of this felt like a sister synagogue. It didn't feel thousands of miles away. It felt very, very close to home. And it led me into Tu Bishvat, where I was really thinking about, you know, what is it that uproots me and what is it that allows me to flourish? I know that there's an ongoing police investigation at the moment, and that the people that they have alleged to have been involved have connected him back to both Birmingham and South Manchester. And Robin, I was wondering how that kind of geographical connection has affected you and your community.
Yeah, I mean, I think the word you used of being uprooted is just very strong, because that was that sense of like it unfolding, just feeling incredibly destabilized and physically like it felt so close to home. And then when the Manchester connection came, and it's across Greater Manchester as well, it hit so deep. And I was in a conversation with some community leaders this week who were just heartbroken that once again Manchester is in the news for these reasons. Because day to day in Manchester, it's a place of like great love, community cohesion, you know, really working together in a liberal attitude of like togetherness. And to again have terror as a headline alongside Manchester was absolutely devastating and quite terrifying, because you realise that this idea of extremism and hate and anti-Semitism is everywhere. Like, it isn't just, and you can kind of do that, you know, that psychological game of, well, it only happens there, right? I'm safe here. And it definitely had that sense for me of, I feel really safe as a British Jew always. And this is just a kind of, I don't know, it's just, it reminds me that I'm a minority and that can be, and we can be vulnerable to all of that and victims. But I guess it's about trying to be, you know, in the vulnerability, finding strength, finding connections with others and finding some power alongside that, and remembering that there is so much goodness out there and so much care. And we've definitely felt that in Manchester. But yeah, all of those energies going on and those feelings that are still with me. I mean, you know, I think they will be with us all for like months to come, won't they?
Absolutely. Debbie, how are you doing?
Yeah, I think it's, as you both said, you know, it felt much closer to home than one might expect for a synagogue that is a 10-hour flight away. And I suppose it's a reminder that in our Jewish world, but even more so perhaps in the progressive Jewish world, we're only ever 2 degrees of separation away from anything. You know, seeing friends who had been watching the live stream when it happened, you know, rabbinic colleagues in America who were supporting the family of the hostages, And I was very, very affected actually on Saturday night by what was going on and that sense of, we don't know how this is going to end. I was sort of endlessly refreshing the news and looking online to see if something had changed. And our wonderful colleague, Cantor Zoe Jacobs, who studied at HUC and has lots of connections to the American Jewish community, was able to share a Havdalah service that was happening in Texas, that they were inviting people to come and join and to support one another. So it was sort of, you know, gone midnight, I think, but I joined that and found so much comfort in the multi-faith voices that were there supporting us, and the Jewish voices too, just coming together to support one another and to send whatever support we could through the universe to Rabbi Charlie Citron Walker and his congregation. We had a Tu B'Shvat Seder on Sunday night and took a moment together to remember and think of what had happened in Texas, but also to honor the fact that we were still wanting to come together as a community, because these things can kind of go two ways, right? They can make you scared to come together, or they can make people really want to make sure they come together. So we wanted to reassert that sense that actually this is not a majority experience that happens all the time. It is happening more in America, unfortunately. But we, you know, I, as Robin, I don't feel unsafe walking into my synagogue, and I never have those thoughts. I did find myself very affected though on Monday morning when I was taking the kids to school. And there's always security at Jewish day schools, but this Monday there were also community support police officers very visible, and that sense of, oh wow, they've had to take extra precautions because, yeah. And that's heartbreaking, really, that our kids, you know, I remember crying the first time Eliana came home from school and said they'd practiced hiding. And I know it's much more common in all schools today to do these things, but I think Jewish schools, unfortunately, have had to do them for much, much longer. And it just breaks your heart that that's the world our kids are growing up in.
I have to admit that although I don't think of myself, you know, as vulnerable or kind of scared when I'm leading a service or things like that. Since the Pittsburgh shooting, I have found myself kind of replaying over and over again a conversation in my head of, you know, what would I say? How would I still be the leader? How would I still be the rabbi in that moment? And what can I do? Rather than what would, you know, clearly we'd all want to do, which was curl up into a ball and let somebody else take charge. And I realize, I think the thing I have found most kind of unsettling with both the community in Pittsburgh and in Texas is that in Pittsburgh, the gunman specifically said that he targeted that synagogue because of the work that the rabbi did with refugees and asylum seekers in the States. And the rabbi in Texas has said that actually he thought this man was, you know, he saw that there was clearly something wrong. He thought that perhaps he was homeless. He invited him into the synagogue and made him a hot drink before the service. And I want to be that rabbi. I want to be the rabbi that's able to welcome in the stranger, who is able both on a one-to-one level, acknowledge that there is somebody at my synagogue door and not be afraid of security, but rather to welcome them in and make them a hot drink and hope to make them comfortable. And I would never want to stop doing important work around social justice and work with asylum seekers and refugees. And yet that was the very reason that those communities were also put at risk. Absolutely. And that feels like a huge responsibility. And that's the piece that terrifies me, that it can be the very thing that leads me to grow, that leads me to feel that I am doing something worthwhile with my life and that I'm, you know, flourishing. That's the thing that could completely uproot me, my community, put other people in danger. I think it's a... It's that kind of leads me into that. So many of the images that we use in our liturgy and our tefillah, you know, we introduce Kaddish each week, talking about the grass that grows in the morning, that grows so green in the morning and then in the evening fades and dies. That kind of how fragile the images of nature give us. And yet also, you know, ideas like Ki Ha'adam Etz Hasadeh, like we, each of us, are like a tree in the field, you know, totally rooted, totally secure, here being able to provide nourishment and shade. What happens when those two images seem to collide so awfully?
Yeah, I also think that sense of just how impressive Rabbi Sitchin Walker has been, and to be able to continue to hold that beautiful sense of what it is to be part of humanity as well as part of the Jewish people. He has spoken so brilliantly, and you know, and he clearly was such a support to his community in that moment. You know, those questions we all ask ourselves, would I be the one curled up in a ball on the floor? You know, he's really an inspiration at this point.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I think that the one thing he said that like actually knocked the breath out of me, and I think is something that I will remember. And, you know, we're thinking about personal growth and Tu B'Shvat. And he said, you know, the interviewer was saying, how did you stay so calm and collected? You know, that like it's come across that you were the leader, you were able to hold it together in some way. And he said, well, as rabbis, we're taught to be calm, non-anxious presence, right? And we do that at hospital beds, at life cycle things. And he went through a list and he said, that's the training. And it still sends chills down me now, because of course that is the core of what a rabbinic leader, well, what I aspire to be. And I also know how much work goes into that, right? Of like, if I attend to my fears and feelings, which we're talking about now, which really helps, you know, if I'm able to be in touch with myself, I'm then able to do, I'm not saying I can do what he did, but, you know, my day-to-day job in a way that is calm and non-anxious, I can, you know, certainly aspire to that. And I think also, you know, it's really interesting what you say, Miriam, about the work of cohesion and reaching out being a source of vulnerability and that being targeted. And I feel so angry about that, and so much more determined that one loud, devastating voice that is acting out of terror and despair, really, because the world is changing. I think the world is getting better. We call out injustice in a way that I don't think we've ever done so loudly or globally before, is that the world is changing, and that there are, you know, there's so much good work going on all the time that is changing the world in ways we can't even understand at the moment, in much more significant and long-lasting ways. And just remembering and having focus on that for me is vital, and actually turning into the work more. And I think I'm so grateful to be Jewish with our particular story of standing up to Pharaohs, David against Goliath, right? Knowing that our story is one, that's a story that lives within me alongside the fear that I have the strength of my ancestors who organized against injustice and terror and hate and anti-Semitism and persecution. And their teachings and their strength are here with us all. Like that is, I'm very grateful to be Jewish and a rabbi, because I get all this terror, and each Shabbat I have to turn to the text and go, right, Torah, what can we teach this week at shul? Like, what are we going to bring? Turn to liturgy, turn to community, even when I feel like I just want to hide. But Judaism just won't let you. It's just like, no, this is what's demanded. Here's what you're commanded to do. You do it with people every single week, every day, really. And I'm very grateful for that. And I get loads of strength and feel kind of energized from that, alongside the fear and the grief that's also going on.
I love the idea that these elements are part of what Judaism gives us, but what we also kind of need to survive. You know, we can look this Tu B'Shvat to the natural world and say, like, it's kind of easy to see their hierarchy of what they need. You know, to make a tree grow, it needs soil, it needs water, it needs air, it needs sun. Like, it's a nice, easy kind of recipe. What do we need? You know, what's our equivalent? We've often laughed about turning to food at moments of stress and anxiety. We know that that food is not just a survival source, but also a kind of something that often we turn to for comfort. People, I think, is so much at the core of each of us. What else do we need that kind of is our, this is what I need to keep going and thriving and surviving?
And it seems cliche to say it at Tu B'Shvat, but I need to be outside for a lot of that. And actually, there's a Japanese idea that I haven't tried, but I really like the idea of called tree bathing, which is that you go into these beautiful forests and bathe in the sort of the trees. And there is something about spending quality time in beautiful outdoor places, or even just outdoors. You know, we go camping most summers, and just waking up to the fresh air and having a cooked breakfast outside and sitting watching the people, but also usually the sea or whatever the view is, the woods, being present without walls that kind of hold us in, and experiencing the world as it moves at its own time and pace and independent of anything that you want to happen beyond your control, and just appreciating the wonder of this life that we only have an outside glimpse at. You know, there's so much teeming life that we don't even see. And I think definitely for my own sense of growth, I need time outdoors in nature and appreciating beautiful places.
Yeah. I mean, I think I'm learning more and more the older I get that I need that, and that I need to move, because I think my habitual self is not someone who would go like for a walk outside or into nature. Maybe being a city girl, I don't know what it is, but I'm learning actually my body needs that. So I'm enjoying that at the moment. I would say my answer, which won't surprise both of you, because I'm such a geek, like at heart. Like I always think like going back to your inner child is a helpful way of knowing that you're connecting to something that helps grow you and enlivens you. So when I was a kid, I used to like just love Hebrew grammar. And I'd like write myself biblical Hebrew textbooks. Really geeky. So
can you write one for me, Robin?
I've got four.
My goodness, I've got Robin, four that I've written over. Friends, like how is
sorry.
This is a much bigger revelation than I think you're really odd. You know, really.
I know, I love it, but and it makes Anthony giggle, because when I'm like in true rest and like feeling like I'm growing or that I'm kind of being fulfilled, I will be like sat with Hebrew, and Anthony will be like, it's your day off, or like go and relax. I'm like, this is deep relaxation. Like what I love is when connections go off in my mind, like, and I'm connecting things, like that intellectual exercise of like, I'm looking at both your faces and you're like, okay.
But like, I'm just thinking, how do I follow this without sounding like, you know, I'm just going straight in there with the academic, and
I love it.
I'm like I bet Anthony actually comes in and just finds you sitting on the couch watching Drag Race, and you're talking about Hebrew grammar. And actually,
yeah, like, don't get me wrong, this isn't about me, I do all of that as well. Like, I will have a day where I don't get out of pajamas and watch Netflix. And it's not like I study all the time, but it's because recently I've restarted something that Rabbi Alan Liu, Zichron Aliv Racha, suggests in one of his books, who's an amazing author, to read an Aliyah of Torah each day as a way of kind of studying towards the parasha at the end. And I've started to do that. So it doesn't take me a lot of time, but
that's
it just
a really
connects
good idea.
Me. Yeah, it's an amazing thing. And I do it to help with my Hebrew and stuff, but it's a small moment of my day. But there's something in it that like I'm investing in myself, that I care about the next step, or like broadening my mind. That really matters. But as you can tell, and as you know by my personality, I've got to be careful with this stuff around growth, because I will set myself like task lists of, well, I'm going to read this book, I'm going to learn that, I'm going to go for my exercise. So I've got to be careful with personal growth, because I can just go off to
suffocated and drowned by her own personal growth list.
Yeah,
I think Hebrew textbooks that buried
exactly
her.
on my gravestone, always I giggle with my friend that on my gravestone, may it be a very long time away, that it will say she overdid it, because literally all I do is
without
overdo
any
it.
Grammatical errors on it. So exactly. Can you imagine how to make sure someone doesn't rest in peace?
Yeah, that's it. Yeah,
tortured by the grammatical error on her headstone.
Oh my gosh, that would definitely be me. Yeah. So go on, Miriam. I've like set that very. I think it's a low bar. But how about you?
It's interesting because I'm not even sure I know what, you know, personal growth really means. I know what I struggled with during lockdown when everything was kind of stripped bare, the things I noticed most, right? It was actually, you know, it took Johnny to say, you and Ben also need to come out the house every day, because our natural instinct was to just, we don't need to go out. Why would we go out? But actually, we did need to go out, and it really helped, and it really changed things. And actually, it's that the personal connections with people that I really, you know, I really struggled with not having. And actually, you know, we had them in spades kind of coming into us via phone and Zoom and email and, you know, all of that. We were very, very, very much as rabbis during lockdown in conversation with and connecting with people. But that lack of kind of a physical presence of people, I realized how much I bounce off of people. I need that kind of that spark that, you know, for me, chavruta is the real essence of what Judaism gives us for our own personal growth. That actually, it's not something I discipline myself to do alone. I need the other half. I need the chavruta in all aspects of my life to do that thing of like, you know, what do we need? And I think for me, I really rely on kind of successes. I want to see my goals. I'm quite goal driven, and I want to see outcomes. And therefore that kind of thing of look what we've achieved, now what can we do next? I feel like I'm constantly kind of striving for something, which I funnel into all sorts of things, whether it's synagogue life or wellspring life, or whether it's kind of family life. There's a kind of thing of kind of what are we doing? What's our project? What are we aiming for at the moment?
I think that Havrusha model around personal growth is really powerful. I think so much of my own Jewish growth as well as personal growth has been connected to having either Havrutot or just dialogues with people who are very different to me, and learning with someone who doesn't agree with everything I say and who will challenge and who will approach the text differently. For about 4 years, it's now paused, unfortunately, but for about 4 years, I had a weekly Havrita with a vicar friend, just reading through the book of Exodus and seeing how far we'd get each time. We didn't set an amount, we would just read. And being able to study it from such a different perspective, we both learned so much. And also, every time you read the text, you find something new anyway. But I've always found that speaking to people who come from a very different perspective, whether that's religious or Jewish or otherwise, it helps you hone who you are and where you sit on something, and just opens the mind to thinking differently about things.
Yeah, that's the beauty, isn't it? I always find that whether it's learning with somebody or chatting to someone, my perspective shifts completely. So I know that left to my own devices, I become an echo chamber of my mind. My mum shared that phrase and I really like it. But like, I'm just in my own mind thinking, like making up stories about myself and about the world out there and about how, you know, I'm uniquely suffering or that there's something wrong with me or how I'm doing something. And as soon as I talk to someone else, whatever context it is, either they're feeling the same thing or they've gone through the same thing or they go, that's so hard, I really hear you. I'm like, oh, so my perspective completely shifts as well, which is really helpful. And I would say, like, I don't know, with this personal growth stuff, you know, there's certain trees that need a wildfire to rip through. They get kind of burnt and destroyed, and they need that so that they can regrow, and the growth is all there. I feel that's for me as well about personal growth. Like, if I think back, my biggest stages of really becoming into myself more, getting to know myself and being able to find my inner strength, have been through some of the hardest times in my life that I would never wish to go through again. And I don't look at them and say, oh, well, I'm glad I went through that because of this, or I went through it so that I could do that. You know, I don't see suffering as a test in that sense. But there's something about dragging the good out of it. And I know that for me, it's the dark, messy, struggly stuff where actually I can probably, more than the Hebrew grammar, I can turn around and say I've actually changed, or I'm transforming or becoming the person I am because I've gone through that, because I've had the wildfire where I've just been brought to my knees, you know, and it's then when I've stood up that I then think, oh, here I am, you know, this is who I am. All of that, really, which is hard.
Yeah, it's interesting. I often come back to something that was so painful when I first heard it. I'm sure I've probably said it to you on one of these conversations before, but I was at Leo Beck as a third year student going into my third year when my mum died, and her rabbinic tutor at the time wrote me a condolence letter and said, you'll be a better rabbi because of this. And I was like, I don't want to be a good rabbi. I just want my mum. You know, I don't want to be a good rabbi. I prefer to have my mum. And now I understand exactly what she meant. And she was absolutely right. That there are things that allow us to see the world in a very different way. And they tend to be the things that have been most painful that you've kind of endured kind of on the way.
I always joke that my family specialised in providing me with pastoral experience before coming into the rabbinate.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's a blessing, something to thank them all for. Robin, you talked about kind of, you know, going back to those stories of your childhood and seeing how your younger you is very much reflected in your current you. I wonder if there's a piece that goes the other way, which is, do you ever have that conversation with your kind of your future self and say, this is, you know, this is what I need to do to get to that point?
Yeah. I mean, I always joke that my, you know, everyone has an inner age. My inner age is about 85. So I cannot wait to be that wise, grounded old woman. I'm so excited to meet her. She's already in me, very much so. But yeah, I think what I would really hope, because I'm sure this is not just me, everyone, I have the same things that I'm trying to get better at or like get through the stories that I tell about myself, which is this narrative I hold, which is very destructive, that I have to do it all, that I, you know, I should be able to do it all. I don't need help. And I'm a massive perfectionist and workaholic. I would really hope that by the time I'm older, I can look back and go, wow, in your 40s, I'm coming to my 40s, you really made a difference in your habitual self, right? And I'm really trying at the moment, and it's making a massive difference, actually, because my Apple Watch tells me it does, because it's got I like to test and look at everything. That's the perfectionism. But my stress level, my resting heartbeat has gone down over the last 13 weeks by 10 beats per minute, because I've made some real changes to how I work and found spaciousness in my work life, because as you know, it can be quite stressful, the jobs we have and what's expected. So I would really hope that in my future self, I can say, yeah, you found spaciousness. You didn't see perfectionism as this thing that you always have to attain and run towards, like that constant treadmill. I just don't want to feel like I'm on a treadmill all the time. And that I learned how to like really be with other people and trust them and to do jobs with people rather than thinking, well, I probably should just do this myself, and seeing it as a, you know, a reflection on my worth. So that's what I'm hoping for when I'm sitting with my 85-year-old self with my feet up, having a hot drink, watching people go by. Can't wait.
It's so funny to hear you talk about your inner self being 85. I think my inner self is 11.
Oh, nice.
And wants to read your Hebrew grammar books.
Oh, so you would have been friends. We would have been friends.
Like, the 11-year-old isn't aware yet that she really should be working on her Hebrew grammar. And I wish she had. I think Hebrew is actually one of those areas of growth that I'm always conscious of. It's one of those things that I feel really self-conscious about, that it's not where I want it to be. I feel like I have lots of other things that I'm great at, but actually, of course, I manage, but my Hebrew is just not where I want it to be. So I genuinely do want to read your books.
Right.
And it's one of those things, actually, I almost can't believe I'm saying this out loud on a podcast, but, you know, I cannot just show up at a Hebrew class as a rabbi and start asking for help with Hebrew. And of course I can, you know, I'm fine, but I want to be better. And it's finding how on earth do I do that? That's quite hard. And also then making the time for it, because there are so many demands. It's how do we find the time for the stuff that we want to invest in and grow in? I am doing something this year that was supposed to happen 2 years ago, but got cancelled because of COVID, that is a sort of, I'm not sure yet if it's growth, but I think it will be. When I was a teenager, and my rabbi suggested I think about being a rabbi, I absolutely wasn't prepared to think about the idea because I didn't really believe in God. And a lot of that was tied up with Shoah stuff. I'm just realizing it's HMD, Holocaust Memorial Day, next week. And I did sort of come to peace with that and find my own theology that helped me sit with that. After visiting a few of the deportation camps and one of the camps in Germany. But I'm going this year, if it all goes ahead, on March of the Living, part of an interfaith delegation. Mm. And I think revisiting that part of my kind of theological struggle and seeing where I am with it now, but actually also just being in the place, it'll be interesting to see where that takes me. I've actually never really been interested in going to Auschwitz as this kind of, it's this symbol of all of the evil.
You mean your parents didn't take you age 9, like mine did?
Oh, wow.
They didn't, no. We went to Turkey instead.
Funny that.
I always said if I do go, it will need to be as part of some kind of educational, like there needs to be a purpose to it. And I've been invited to go as part of an interfaith delegation. And that feels like the right way of doing this, that it's not only about, I don't know, horror tourism, but using this horror for a purpose. And I think finding long term how we find all the world's horrors and use them for purpose, I suppose that's growth in a way.
It's extraordinary. I hope that we will revisit in the podcast your reflections on going to Auschwitz, because I went as part of my dad's adult education group. Yeah. He now, I understand incredibly wisely, like, took the whole family as a, like, the people on the group could see the future too, if you know what I mean. Like, as the kids there was a real sense of, we are still growing and the Jewish community is still alive whilst we were there. And I understand actually how powerful an image that must have been and made a very different dynamic for the group. And recently, like, when I say recently, I mean pre-COVID, we did a synagogue trip with Jeremy Lee, which I very, very different experiences, but it is an extraordinary place to visit.
I do think there's an interesting conversation to be had at some point, maybe not today, about the shifting generational educational approach around this stuff. Because as a child, and we're more or less the same age, I don't remember the moment I was told about the Holocaust. I just knew. I knew my family's
there.
Stories. Mm-hmm. I knew that this was part of who we were. And I don't remember this kind of heartbreaking moment of... And I've been much more calculating, I think, in what I tell my children when. And, you know, I think about age six, there was a book about great women who changed the world that Eliana had. And one page was about Anne Frank, but very, very gently. You know, it talked about persecution of the Jews. It talked about her dying, but it didn't talk about murder and how she died. And yeah, I think that shift in how we pass that on is also about growth as a community and who we see ourselves as. But that might be another story for another day. Miriam, what does your future self want to grow in?
I think kind of what's interesting for me is I guess it's hard in when we do our job, we do a lot of funerals. And this is going to be a strange thing to say, but I love eulogies. I think there is something so beautiful about what comes out in the way that we tell someone's story just after they die. And I'm fascinated by legacy of people's lives. And for me, I think there's a constant question, you know, in terms of, like, what will I have actually changed? What will I have actually done? And is it enough for it to be, like, about individuals and maybe about community? Like, surely there's a legacy that's bigger than that. And I don't mean having my name on a building or, you know, being known for something. I mean something much, much more subtle than that. Just about, you know, will the world be a different place because I was in it? And I think that's my constant kind of battle with myself of, you know, if today was my last. I think because of, you know, my mum dying in her 50s, for me, being in my 40s, there's a real sense of, you know, I should be so lucky to sit with my 85-year-old self. I don't make that assumption. And therefore, there's a kind of piece of, you know, in whatever time I have, please God, many decades, but if not, you know, what does that mean? Like, why will the world be changed because I was here? And I think I give myself quite a hard time about wanting to push myself further and further to make sure that there is a difference, that there is a reason that I was here.
I so deeply resonate with what you've said. And I think it's one of the greatest blessings I find in the job is that sense of talking to families and the stories that come out. And it was actually through doing a eulogy for a woman called Stella Feldman, who I didn't know, but her daughters were just wonderful. And the stories poured out and they said she lived life to the full. A lot of families say that. Stella really, really did. And I, after really reflected and thought, what do I want on my gravestone? That's why the joke came out, oh, she overdid it. I thought, actually, it's a chance of being able to say, what would I want? It's like, oh, that she lived life to the full, right? That's really important. And it's a great, it's quite a dark exercise to do, isn't it? To think about it. But I did it with Anthony Vaughan.
I think it's a great idea. What do you want people to have remembered of you? What are the things that really matter? You know, because we do so much in our day-to-day that is administrative or time consuming, but actually what's the stuff that really matters that we want to put our energy into? I think it's a really positive exercise. I'd love to hear what our listeners think they want on their gravestones.
Yeah, but I would recommend like not doing it with your partner, because I think it's like rabbis, we're like in particular spaces, we're talking these things through, you know, it's in context of what we do. It's normal, right? But I said to Anthony on a long car trip back from Scotland, what would you say of my eulogy? It's quite a weird question. And he started with the phrase, she was opinionated. I was like, really? That's where you'll start? And am I? But there is like a therapeutic, it's used as a therapeutic tool and a coaching tool of actually what would you write for your eulogy? And it being a really uplifting, positive exercise to do. So yeah, do it gently, I would say, but it's a good one to do.
I would also say don't try and do it in the car if you're driving. I think it was before my dad's stone setting, I was trying to write a eulogy in my head to get notes down later, and I would end up driving along crying, trying to write this eulogy in my head. Like, no, crying and driving are not a good combination.
Yeah.
I don't think there's anybody that I really love that I haven't had a dark moment lying in bed with their eulogy going through my head, like making me cry. Like somehow there's been a reason in everybody's kind of like, for me to start everybody I love's eulogy in that kind of terrifying, I hope never to have to give this. But like, why am, like, there's something about our crazy jobs that drive us into that strange headspace.
Yeah.
I'm not sure it is strange, though. I think there's
I like that
fear.
Kind of affirmation.
There's a fear that our society has in talking about death and in acknowledging that we are all mortal and none of us are going to live forever. And actually having those conversations with each other and with family, and whether it's about organ donation or what you want remembered or your eulogy or, who are the rings going to go to? There are so many conversations that would help us deal with death better that I think sometimes we're too scared to have because we can't talk about death unless we're in our world.
Right. Unless you're the rabbi's family. And then it's okay to have things like, we have one rule in our family. We only have one rule. Our rule is no dying. And there are many things that we therefore have like sub clauses, like we have to be careful when crossing the road because it may lead to breaking the one rule we have. But, you know, for me, there's something around that idea that I think one of my biggest kind of concerns is that were I ever to be, you know, taken away suddenly from this world, that Ben would always know it was the last thing I wanted. Like to leave him was the last thing I ever wanted. And that, you know, that was what I was always striving for in life, to be there for him and to be able to be whatever support he needs in his life.
Oh, Miriam. God. Yeah. I mean, that's the beauty of this. That's really emotional. That's the beauty though of being with this, like Debbie said, is that, and you know, your personal journeys, both of you as well, having such close bereavements, of like turning into life even more fully, that's where it leads me to. Whenever I've done a funeral, I don't feel dejected or despairing or fearful. I mean, sometimes sure, but like a lot of the time it's like, okay, this is how I want to live my life, this is what I'm committing to, this is who I want to be. And I don't know whether to link back to the Texas thing, but in some ways, for me, it does. Because I know that if I can attend to those deep fears, and if we can talk in this way of like having the really hard, dark, deep conversations, that actually that fear is expelled and it's used, it's different. I'm not taking it out on people or projecting or running towards something that is dangerous or easy or hateful. That actually it's about that conversation not only is helpful therapeutically, it actually can change the world. If people can come to terms with what mortality is and that the world is not certain, it's, you know, it's fluid and it's flexible and it's chaotic. The more that we can attend to that, and I think as rabbis, we see it all the time because we're involved in people's lives. You know, you think there's a perfect family there. Hmm. There's no such thing because everyone has their struggles. You know, everyone is struggling with something. And the more you get that, I think it just helps you see the fabric of life and the connection, which is, you know, what's all trees are about, isn't it? The rootedness underneath everything, that we're all connected.
For me, that's also the beauty of the rituals that we have around death, right? We are meant to feel it. We're meant to deal with it and wail and cry and remember and talk and share and get it out. because in doing that, it lets us live better after. It helps us to return to life and live it more fully. And I just think that's the greatest gift.
Yeah.
I want to mention, kind of going back to what we were talking about in our last podcast, it sort of comes back to that again, these sense of self-growth and self-care and thinking about who we want to be. We talked last time about the Honeycomb Project, which we're running in collaboration with Liberal Judaism. And if these are kind of issues that affect you, or you want to think about how you can support others in your community in going through these processes, and maybe even just talking about death when it's looming, volunteering to help support people in crisis or with all sorts of challenges through life. The Honeycomb Project is helping to train volunteers, lots of opportunities for Jewish learning, growth, development. And of course, just in doing that, you also get the huge benefit of what it means to be a volunteer. So if you want more information about getting involved in those kind of things, we've got reformjudaism.org.uk/honeycomb, which is where you can find out more information about skilling yourself up to do some of this stuff.
And as we said, you know, it's so lovely to be part of these conversations. I love rabbiting on. I often forget that anyone's ever going to listen to this conversation, because I just like to talk to Robin and Debbie. But I realize you are out there and listening. And so if you want to contribute to this conversation, if you want to drop us a line with your thoughts, where you find your personal growth, maybe even where you think our personal growth should be heading towards.
Oh my gosh, no, I don't want to know. You can keep that to yourself.
Or if you've got ideas for future topics and things you'd like us to be talking about at Rabbiting On, then do email the team on media@rjuk.org.
Can I just say, you meant, by the way, I've just realised you meant the podcast, like how we can grow the podcast. You didn't mean personally. Happy to hear what people think about growing the podcast. I meant I don't need personal growth for myself. That was, just to clarify.
That's when all of our chairmen start writing screeds of emails to us going, oh, brilliant, personal growth, this is where you could improve.
Yeah. Podcast, great, go for it. Yeah.
We are back, as always, in a couple of weeks, talking about the joys of being a rabbi and all that nourishes us, and topics to look forward to. So until then, thank you so much for listening.
Bye.
See you soon.
Bye.